Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Stephen Downs.
Hi, everyone. It's the great golf separates us here tonight because we're just getting the slides set up. What I'm going to talk about today is the topic of e-learning 2.0. I've talked about this in previous talks in the past, and those of you, I'm very surprised at how many of you read my newsletter. For those of you who do read the newsletter, a lot of the material in this talk will be pretty familiar. It covers a lot of themes that I've covered before, and I think you'll find that it's pretty familiar with respect to a lot of the initiatives that you've been undertaking yourselves in providing learning programs for yourselves and your staff. There's always a danger when you come in and you do a talk like this, and the idea that you're presenting something, it's the facts, the truth, this is the way it is, I know I know on the line, I'm the expert in the guru, they're all the mob, and that's not how I view this material at all. And so I want to preface that I'm looking at a particular slice of online learning, not the whole field of online learning, obviously. There are many things, including the wonderful helicopter simulation in Gage Town that I got to fly once and crashed very quickly.
7 seconds.
Is it still a record? All the way across through the Second Life stuff that you saw to the I had it written down on a napkin and I've now lost it. Here we go. The company command software that you heard about, I guess, yesterday from May Allen and the rest. This is just one small part of it, and it's one person's perspective on it. It's not all a seamless whole. It's not a beautiful step-by-step narrative that wraps up nicely and neatly in a bow like a Sherlock Holmes movie or short story. It's something that's still a bit loose and scrambly, and something that you should take, look at critically, analyze from your own perspectives, take what you need, discard the rest, and take it from there. So I want to begin this talk by talking about reality, and I know that seems like an odd sort of place to begin a talk, but perhaps it's appropriate because we've just finished a demonstration from Second Life. A lot of the times we hear about our own discipline, our own domain being talked about as virtual reality, but you know, my background is in philosophy, and as a philosopher, I've learned over time to look at reality from different perspectives and different lights. You know, we often hear the phrase, the reality is, as a rhetorical device, and you know, I'm sure you've all heard it, right? Yeah, yeah, this great plan, you know, I think we should do such and such, and someone come along, but yeah, but the reality is. Sounds familiar. The reality is the enemy of innovation. When we look at reality, when we analyze what reality is, almost everything that we think is real, properly so-called, is construction. It's an artifact. It's something that we have created. It's a way that we have used, a way that we've used. Isn't that wonderful grammar, Steve? It's a way that we understand the world. It's a device that we use in order to understand the world. Kant's talked about space and time as the necessary prior conditions of perception. The idea here is that we don't know that space and time exist absolutely, certainly, you know, for all time, but as perceiving, thinking humans, the only way for us to make any sense of our perception whatsoever is to come up with the concept of space, to come up with the concept of time, to create a framework in order to place our many different perceptions and to come up with some understanding of them, an explanation of them, a way of dealing with them. David Hume called them useful fictions. But there are many ways of looking at real in today's world. We think of real, on the one hand, we contrast it with the artificial. So the real is like the natural, the artificial is like the fake. And we can think of real as genuine, as the actual thing, or real as the fake thing that is not the original. It's just a pale imitation. We have Coke, it's the real thing, and by implication, Pepsi is the fake thing. Pepsi should have done that. They should have come out with the advertising, and I bet you it would have worked. Pepsi, fake Coke. That would have worked, I tell you. These days, of course, we also have the contrast between the real and the virtual. Analyze that. What does that mean, right? Because the virtual is every bit as real as the real, except that it's not physical. But, I mean, it's not like the things that are going on in Second Life are artificial or fake. Well, maybe they are. How about real versus illusory? We have the idea of real, something that exists. A mirage is not real, not because we don't perceive it. We do perceive it, but it's not real because it does not, in fact, exist. Now, does this sense of real apply to something like Second Life? When we look at Second Life, we would say, that doesn't exist. Not really. That's not the sort of thought that goes through our mind, is it? We have real versus delusion. The idea here of having a grasp of reality is having a grasp of sanity, being able to make sense of your perceptions without all the static or interruptions that somebody who is deluded might think. Is there a great conspiracy? Do we need to wear tinfoil hats? Well, that's not reality, is it? And hence we have the admonition of people, get real, as in become sane again. Now, there are many ways to find realities, many ways of sensing, perceiving, touching, measuring, many different points of view. We have different perspectives, different models. Models tell us what things exist and what things don't exist. It's an interesting thing. Here we have, look at this right in front of you. We have here a podium, right? We say, this podium exists. This light exists. This light is part of this podium. It's almost artificial the way we give this particular podium an identity. It depends on a certain perspective, a certain worldview. And so as I talk about this, think about what the quote-unquote realities are in the real world. And I've been thinking about a lot of the challenges that national defense is facing these days. And there are very many different realities, shifting realities, changing realities that you're dealing with. Think about the realities, the constructs that we will accept as real, that characterize your institution, that characterize your students or your fellow staff, that characterize your values. What of your values is real? What of your values is artificial? What is a construct? What is fake? What is deluded? Your finances. My finances are very, very heartbreakingly real. So, against that background, now, I want to drive the traditional conception of knowledge. And the traditional conception of knowledge is exactly that conception that I tried to warn you against as I took to this podium today. The traditional conception of knowledge is where things like knowledge, facts, values, institutions, are real in all the full senses of the world and unchanging. They are presented, here they are, you will consume. Even change, which is kind of ironic in a way, is viewed as inevitable, is viewed as real, is viewed as something that is out of our control. People talk about change management. Change management is getting people to accept change. That is something that they cannot control, they just have to deal with. That's one way of perceiving change management. Too many ways. The reality is, especially in today's world, and I'll have different ways of talking about that as I go through this talk, the reality is we define what counts as real. We define it by our theories, our worldviews, our underlying values, our moralities, our religions, our perceptions, our beliefs, our intuitions, our different systems of logics, mathematics, all of these things. create a reality. And it's not on the slide, but I will say this. Oh, it is on the slide. Not nice. This reality is different for each person. This, and it's very different for each person. Look at all of you right now. Reality is based partially on perception. You're all looking at me, true. It's not to be a complex. but if reality is what you perceive, each of you is perceiving me from a slightly different angle, which means that we've got about 100 different versions of Stephen Downs sitting in this room, which is even more disturbing. Here's another exercise, and this is a particularly relevant exercise for this organization. What is a student? What is a natural student? What is a genuine student? What is a physical versus a non-physical student? An existing or non-existing student? An actual or non-delusional or non-deluded student? You know, we have this way of dividing the world. You know, teacher and student, and never the twain shall meet except in a classroom. But these categories, even the idea of real and unreal, existing and non-existing students, are beginning to change, beginning to become fuzzified. And fuzzified, yes, is a word. Here's another challenge for you about real. What is learning? We you know, particularly with the emphasis of testing and repetition and all that, you may get the impression that learning is something that we have a very good grasp of, that we know what it is. It's remembering, say, or something like that. But what is learning? What is natural learning? What is genuine learning? What is physical learning? Learning from experience as opposed to learning from virtual reality. Are those two different kinds of learning, or is it the same kind of learning created in a different way? What is existing learning? How can you have existing learning if learning isn't a thing? You have a thing that isn't really a thing, you can't just say that it exists. You see what I mean? This is the problem when you study philosophy. You look at these words, you come into a domain like education, and people say, well, there is learning, and there are facts, and there are textbooks, and you look at that and say, well, yeah, but the world isn't like that. The reality is, learning has changed. Learning has changed from being about reality, from being about facts and objects and things and dates and names and ways of building things and ways of taking things apart, to being about ways of creating understanding, coping with, managing reality, to verify reality, being able to determine what is true in our perspective, what is not true in our perspective, to creating reality, to making reality. The skill that it takes to build something in Second Life is a type of learning, but it's learning how to produce, how to create. It's learning in an age that has changed. We used to live in a world that was very certain. You had a cause, you had an effect. You knew what created a cause and effect. You did one thing, something else followed. These days, with multiple complex interrelated variables, you do one thing, you sometimes don't know what's going to happen. It's learning in an age of obscurity, where the reality is simply not known. The reality is beyond our perception, like constant space and time. It's learning in an age of chaos, with multiple independent variables, where from the same cause, you can get one of a range of effects. It's like predicting the weather, which is particularly relevant today. It's learning in an age of change, where what was true today ceases to be true tomorrow. This changes very much the way we have to go about learning. The old model, this was a guy that's just a few years old. This old model is less than a decade old. It's the old transmission model, the idea of learning as content, as facts, and you take the facts and you assemble them in some way, and maybe you run them through the gears of a learning management system, and then I love the way the delivery device shoots them into people's brains. As though, you know, if you shoot something hard enough, it'll lodge in their brain and become learning. That's the old transition model. And the problem with that model isn't that it didn't work. The problem is that it did work. The problem is that that kind of learning shoots facts into people's brains in a world where the current facts. Learning is not remembering. Learning isn't simply acquiring facts, because that will not give you the capacity to deal with the world. It will not allow you to create space. It will not allow you to create time. Learning, you can remember things without meaning. This is from, what's his name? Lewis Carroll. This was brilliant, it was slightly tough, blah, 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 blah. I can't remember it. It's kind of ironic. But anyways, I remember those words, 'twas brilliant, having a clue what they mean. Could I be said to have learned those words if I have no idea what they mean? Or another example, mathematics. Everybody took mathematics in school, and most people passed that. And yet, when they go into the workplace, I used to work in concession stands and 7-Eleven stores and things like that. Every time an employee comes to the store, we teach them a new skill. We teach them what's called counting change. And the reason why we teach them to count change is that even though they have passed grade 12 mathematics, they do not understand that if somebody gives you a 20 for a 79-cent item, you don't give them a 50 change. Because they don't associate the mathematics with the value. The syntax of the mathematics doesn't associate the semantics of being a 7-Eleven clerk. So counting change is a process that ensures that the change corresponds to what was actually given to them. So if somebody gives you a 20, you count the money back and add it up so you get 20 again. So they can learn math, oddly, interestingly, without understanding what math is supposed to do. We actually see that all the time. Learning is not content, and I know it used to be content is king, content is the web. Learning is not content. It is not shooting those facts into your head. Rather, learning, as I characterize it in this slide, is a process of becoming rather than a process of acquiring. Now, when I say something like that, I sound like one of those German philosophers who's about to start making up words. And that's not really what I want to do, but rather what I want to say is learning is a process of creating a particular mental configuration, a particular set of connections between the neurons in your mind. Learning is shaping yourself rather than acquiring something. To learn, as the slide says here, is to instantiate patterns of connectivity. So what you're doing is it's like exercising, right? You don't become strong by putting muscles into your arm. That'd be kind of neat, be like Schwarzenegger. You don't put muscles into your arm. You have to grow muscles, you have to develop them, and you do that through certain processes. And I imagine you guys understand those processes much better than I do. What learning really is on this model, therefore, is not propositional. It's not a sentence. It's not a bunch of sentences. It's not a bunch of facts. Very often, it is tacit. To use the words of Michael Pollan in Personal Knowledge, learning is like riding a bicycle. You could not describe what it is to know how to ride a bicycle. You can sit there and you can write it out, write sentence after sentence after sentence. And the person can read all of those sentences and still not know what it's like to ride a bicycle. It is knowing how to ride a bicycle is, again, following Blanche, is in an important sense ineffable. It is not expressible in words. And as an aside, this means that the efforts to, as they say, quote unquote, capture tacit knowledge are misguided. What they are attempting to do is take something that is ineffable, not expressible in words, and express it in words. And obviously, when you do that, you've changed something important. You've taken something that is knowledge and changed it into something that is not knowledge. Learning and knowledge are also, very importantly, personal. What you learn, what you know, depends on context. That means, in a very important sense, you can't generalize it. You can't say, because I know this fact about the world, this fact about the world should be what is known by every other person in the world. Because what I know about very much depends on my own perceptions, my own background, my own culture, my own experiences. What knowing is, on this picture, changes as well. Knowing, to know something, used to be to know the rules, to know the categories, to put things in their place, to understand the laws of nature. On the new picture, knowing now is much more about patterns. It's much more about similarities. It's not knowing that a tiger is a kind of cat. Rather, it's being able to recognize a tiger when you see it. And we can see how this works from the perspective of a network. And we see both the aspects of recognition here, and we see the aspects of ineffability or tacitness here. This is a network. It's a very stylized network. A network of this type is properly known as a neural network. This is a term from connectionism more than a term from neurophysiology. And the idea here is that our perceptions, such as that perception of a tree, correspond to a pattern of connectivity in that network. And it's kind of hard, well, really hard for me to see here, but you see the darker red lines that are intended to represent that. So you see the tree, and as you see trees over and over and over and over and over through your life, that creates a pattern of connections between various neurons in your mind. And obviously, this is a gross simplification. That's about 20 neurons, and the mind has about 10 billion or whatever neurons. So the actual patterns of connectivity are very different. Now, what's important here is no single neuron corresponds to the perception of a tree, and indeed there is no propositional representation of that perception of a tree. It is what we would call sub-symbolic. Another aspect of a network that operates in this way is that the same network manages multiple perceptions. Here we have a network that has three separate perceptions. It can recognize three different types of objects. It can recognize a tree, which again is the strong connections in the red. It can recognize this cute little puppy dog with the, I can't really see the colors, the different colored connections. And then it can recognize a couch with yet different colored perceptions. What's really important here is to understand that the same network carries the representations of all three of those objects, and that those representations are, they're not like pictures, they're not like words, they're like patterns of connectivity. And what's interesting about this is, change my perception of a couch, and even though it is not in any way logically connected to a tree, it changes my perception of a tree, because they're operating in the same environment. The mechanisms by which networks learn, the mechanisms by which networks form these connections, tell us about the mechanisms through which learning happens in humans, and for that matter, through which learning happens in societies or networks of people in the world. I've identified three major types of mechanisms by which these connections are formed in this diagram here. One is Hebbian associationism, which is based on, as the slide says, concurrency. If two neurons are activated at the same time and not activated at the same time, a connection is drawn between them. Based on backpropagation, two neurons draw a connection between them and then send the signal forward. From that signal forward, a signal is sent back that may correct that original creation of a connection. And then finally, the Boltzmann mechanism, which is a settling out mechanism. If you have a set of neurons and a set of connections connecting those neurons, a Boltzmann mechanism will try to find the most stable configuration, the configuration of lowest energy. Think about it by analogy, throwing a stone into a puddle of water. The puddle of water will ripple for a while, but eventually it will settle out into the most stable configuration, which is, for water, flat. And the mind works the same way. The connections go back and forth. You can create a perception in a person's mind. You can visualize the connections going back and forth, and eventually the mic just sort of settles into the most stable configuration. Obviously, talking about those principles of association, I've glossed over quite a bit of detail there. And that gives us a picture or a model of what learning looks like in this network environment. And I've represented it with this diagram. This diagram merges or combines two major functions. On the one hand, the function of teaching, which could be said to be to model or to demonstrate, to present perceptions for other people, to receive things for them, to emulate things for them to follow. And then on the other hand, the process of learning itself, which is to practice and to reflect, to practice a lot like exercising, and then to reflect, which is similar to the Boltzmann mechanism, to try to comprehend, to understand, to put into context, to align with the previous beliefs, the experiences that you've had. These four things combined together, modeling, demonstrating, practice, and reflection, form the four cornerstones of the learning experience. And then through that learning experience is the personalization or the context dependency of the learning experience, beginning up at the top with the exercise of choice by the learner, which manifests itself in a definition of an identity for a learner, which in the end expresses itself as creativity. Now, very important, this is a model. This is not the way the world is. This is a framework that I'm using in order to try to grasp or apprehend this process. I'm not coming here and saying, oh yeah, the whole world is defined by these seven elements. That's not what I mean at all. I'm trying to give you a perspective or a point of view on this process. So we have, in summary, e-learning 2.0, the idea that learning is not based in objects and contents and books and course objects and classes and lessons that are stored as though they were in a library, but rather the idea that learning is like a utility, learning is part of our experience, learning is something that flows, learning is something that's dynamic, that changes. It is this network, both externally and externally, reacting and adapting to a wide variety of perceptions. So, that leads us to the underlying concept of e-learning 2.0. The first aspect of that concept is that learning is learner-centered. That is to say, it is centered around the interests of the learner. I would also say, it's not on here, but I would also say it's centered around the perspectives of the learner, the situation or the context that the learner finds themselves in, the job that they're doing, and all of that. And learning is also importantly owned by the learner, rather, again, than just simply being the reception of content. It is something that is managed, created, and deployed, that word, by the learner. I don't want to say used because that would imply that it exists, and I don't want to say it like that either. But you get the idea of what I mean. It's something that the learner does. The learner is not a passive receiver. The learner is an active creator of their own learning. The second major aspect, we've seen this already in the presentation today, it's immersive learning. It's learning by doing. The third major aspect is it's connected learning. It's connected learning in the sense that we're creating connections in the mind, but it's also connected learning in that the learning occurs through the process of creating connections with other people in the world, teachers, other learners, colleagues, whatever, and working with those connections, receiving information, sending information. Learning is, as the slide says, based on conversation and interaction. Some examples, and again, we've seen this already with Second Life, and of course, the simulations that you all use, game-based learning. Clark Aldrich, one of those two. I don't know why I confuse them. has identified four major types of learning: the branching spreadsheet, quiz games, simulation types of learning. Just as an aside, for those of you who work in SCORM and learning design, SCORM and learning design really amounts to only the branching type of learning and not the other types of learning. I would not think of a SCORM application that was a spreadsheet type of game like SimCity or something like that. Another example of this learning is with Jay Cross called workflow learning or informal learning. This is learning where the learning and the process of doing your job or doing your work happen at the same time and in the same place using the same device. Electronic performance support systems, for example, which are applications that actually provide learning inside the application that you're working on. And I'm sure you're familiar with those. Where we see this most of all, interestingly, is in games, where if a person is playing a game, the learning for the game has to be inside the game, because the game player will not read the manuals. Absolutely won't read the manual. There's no point giving them a manual. So whatever learning the player is going to need during the playing of the game has to be inside the game. Also related to this is the model of community of practice, as described by Etienne Grenier. Again, the community of practice, the idea of the community of practice is that this community exists right inside the workplace. And you might wonder about that. We did some work with municipal officials in Alberta, in northern Alberta, and we asked them what their primary means of learning was on their job. And their primary means, if they needed to learn something, what they did is they picked up the telephone and they called somebody. They called a town manager in another town. And basically, what their learning model was to have access to their community of practice right on their desktop. And they just picked up the phone and called somebody. That was learning for them. And that model can be applied to the online world as well. It can be applied to the much more complex learning and working environments we find ourselves in today. Environment visualization technologies, and again, the helicopter that so famously crashed is an example of learning inside an environment, being able to provide visualization for me to understand what it feels like flying a helicopter. Another aspect is mobile learning. One of the things that I've always said from the very beginning is that e-learning is an online learning are not about being tied to a computer. They're not about sitting at a desk looking at a computer screen. Concordant with the idea of immersive learning is the idea of learning in the place where learning is most appropriate. The slogan I've used for many years is the best place to learn about a forest is in a forest. The best place to learn about law is in a courtroom. And what these technologies now provide us is access to learning materials in the physical situation where learning is most needed. One aspect of that, just as an aside, is again learning. And I want to emphasize: learning isn't simply the consumption of information. Learning is also the production of information. So, learning and mobile learning isn't just about getting content like flashcards or drills or even instant messages while you're out there in the field. It's also about resource capture. Here I am on the road. Well, I'm not going to lift it up because I'll just drop it. I have a microphone there. I'm recording this talk. I see somebody else is recording this talk. Hi all of you out there in video land. I always like to put a personal message to people who are, it's about capturing the learning as well. And one of the major things that we see in e-learning, especially e-learning 2.0, is the idea that the process of learning is inherently the process of capturing and creating new learning content. Online learning, on the one hand, we look at our own environments, we've developed tools and systems intended to support traditional classroom learning, the learning management system, the learning objects, SCORM, learning design, that whole infrastructure. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. On the other hand, what we should be doing, what we need to be doing, and what we could be doing is developing tools and systems to support immersive learning, personal learning, dynamic learning, as I say there, living systems. The first iteration of this is user-produced media, as I say. Blogs and blogging is a very simple example. Podcasting and broadcasting. Again, Nate talked about Company Command yesterday. One of the major things that makes a site like Company Command work is that the members of that site are actually creating the learning materials. They're drawing their own perspectives, their own experiences, and they're contributing it to that site. There are many ways of producing content, and particularly with the new technologies, we are able to more and more easily produce very good multimedia content. Not just text content like blogs and blogging, although that's very important. I guess I should mention Twitter, because people were talking about Twitter, which is very short textual content. But also podcasting, as I'm doing with my audio recording here. Vodcasting, which she's doing with her video recording there. Game modifications, and other multimedia are now very easily in the hands of people. People are able to create very simply complex multimedia. I'm playing right now, if you look at my website, I'm playing right now with something called Kaltura, K-A-L-T-U-R-A. What Kaltura is a system that allows me to create a video. Okay, I've created either recorded off my own video, I have a little video camera on my computer, or I can upload some clips and grab them from YouTube or whatever. And so I create my video, and I can add voiceovers, whatever to it. I put it online on my website, and then the next person who comes along can edit my video. And so there's a website out there called Wiki Educator, which is using these Kaltura videos, and what they're doing is, for the different subjects, they're having user-generated, user-created videos, educational videos on the different topics, where people who come along after the video was created add their own segments to the video. Amazing. Who would have thought that 10 years ago? Oh, and of course, it's all free. Of course. So we have Web 2.0, the learning network. The idea of this place, this third place, this virtual place, that is an intersection between education and work at home, that allows us access to easy-to-use tools supported by hosting services like Kaltura or Flickr or YouTube, and allow us to create, to create types of learning, such as, for example, the e-portfolio is blog kind of learning. The idea here is that your learning is creating and presenting materials online. I used to use the, still use the slogan, aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward as characteristics of the learning process. The aggregate is to bring in content, information from multiple sources. In other words, to reach out to all of your connections online. To remix is to bring different things from different sources together. To repurpose is to shape it to your own needs, to your own learning context, and very importantly, to feed forward, to distribute this new material either as a video or multimedia or a blog post or whatever to other people in your network. This learning is unorganized, it's unmanaged, it doesn't have an outcome or a purpose. It is based on the flow, the communication, the content of the moment. It doesn't have presenters and receivers. It's characterized by the unconference. I'm not sure if you've seen a whole lot of the unconference movement that has sprung up recently. The idea of the unconference movement is a bunch of people, like you say, get together, and there is no predefined agenda as to what will be talked about. Different people volunteer to talk about different things. They just write what they're willing to talk about on a notice board on the side of the room. And people decide to create their agenda at the time they're having their conference. And sometimes people talk, sometimes people don't talk. And the content and the well, the entire structure of the conference is decided by the participants. Importantly, not by votes or anything like that, but by each participant doing what they feel is most helpful to them at that point in time. And what typically happens is they group into different clusters, one cluster talking about one thing, another cluster talking about another thing. The idea here is that they are producing the best possible learning for themselves that they could have produced at that point in time with those people. It's messy. It's messy as opposed to neat. It's all previously defined structures. You know, look at it by contrast to this conference, nothing personal to the organizers. Here you are, you're all sitting here listening to me. Is this the absolute best use of your time that you could possibly have it at this point in time? You can be honest with yourself because you're not going to say that a lot, are you? Right. What's the situation here has been predefined, right? There was a conference organizer who, for reasons unknown, picked me, brought me here through freezing rain, and now here I am talking to you, right? And they had the best intent, and of course they made the best decision that they could, given the resources that they had at the time. And, you know, it may have been pretty good, but is it the best? Could you collectively have done a better job with the resources that you had? And the proposition by the unconference movement is, yes, you working together to organize yourselves could come up with a better structure, a better use of your time right now than a single or small group of people organizing this conference for you. That's the proposition. Again, it's the idea of user-generated content, user-generated conferences, user-generated learning as a whole. Again, it's based on flow. We talked about, just mentioned Twitter in passing. Twitter is flow defined. Twitter is 140 character messages. You're not going to have anything static and permanent with Twitter. You're going to get messages to the effect, what are you doing right now? And the idea here is that learning is to immerse yourself in this flow, not to try to capture this flow, not to try to control or hold this flow, but rather to learn how to adapt oneself to this flow. Douglas Rushkoff used to talk about the internet as being like surfing, and learning on the internet as being like learning how to surf. And a person who surfs doesn't try to capture the wave, doesn't try to come to, you know, one single concrete understanding of the wave, because there is no such thing. A person who learns how to surf learns how to adapt him or herself to the wave, drawing all their experience and all their perceptions to make minute adjustments to be able to react to the wave as it changes, as it forms. So we have Web 2.0. That's the concept. I just want to look briefly at some of the core technologies that underlie this. And can I ask how much time do I have? Or, oh, there we go. Quarter to
15 minutes.
See, I have a watch here, which I'm using to keep time, but it's 10 minutes fast, so I don't trust myself. Time is McTaggart used to wrote a paper called The Unreality of Time, and I believe him. First underlying tool of Web 2.0 technologies are social networking tools to create these learning networks. Social networking tools are very simply defined as tools that allow you to create lists of your friends, connect to them, and use those lists to interact with them. The earliest social networking tools are things like instant messaging, ICQ, where you have a list of buddies, Skype, where you have a list of contacts, and now we have sites like Friendster and Orkut, and Facebook, and all of the rest, where you can very explicitly draw out a list of friends. These social networking technologies, I'll just point out, are very much in flux right now. The future of learning is not Facebook, no matter what you've read. The future of learning is indeed not going to be any social networking site, properly so called, but rather something called something that is much more distributed. Tim Berners-Lee called it, and I quote, the giant global graph, GGG, Tim Berners-Lee. the idea that each person's contribution to this web-wide social network is a standalone thing, not connected to any particular website like Friendster or Orkut, and then connecting to other people anywhere they are on the web, rather than other people who are in Orkut or in Friendster or anything like that. That's what is being developed. There's a whole movement on social data portability, and as well, and it comes up a bit later, OpenID, which makes that possible. I'll mention that a little bit later because it's on the slide. Another underlying technology, and again, this speaks to the messiness and the uncontrolled nature of Web 2.0, is tagging. Tagging is a very simple phenomenon. A person presented with a resource like a photograph or a video or a web page or even an object picks a word off the top of their head that they believe describes that object, rather than selecting a word or a classification from a controlled vocabulary in a taxonomy. The idea of tagging is that people create their own vocabulary through use. And this is interesting because this creates organizations and structures of concepts that might not have been, and perhaps could not have been, anticipated by taxonomists or librarians. Another major technology underlying Web 2.0 is something called asynchronous JavaScript and XML. And the name sounds complex, it looks complex, but it's actually very simple. When you submit information to a website, the old Web 1.0 way, and I know you've all done this, the typical way you do it is you type information into a form, you know, fill out your name, address, blood type, mother name, bank account number, the rest. Then you hit submit, the page reloads. What AJAX does is it allows you to enter information in the same way, but instead of reloading the entire page, a JavaScript using something called HTTP request sends a message to a web server. The web server sends a message back to the JavaScript, and then the JavaScript updates just that little bit of the page that is relevant. So, for example, if you're logging in, here's your page, you have a little login form, you fill out your name, password, hit submit. Instead of the whole page reloading, a little JavaScript sends a message, gets a result back, and then just changes the little box where you log in. This is important because it allows web pages to become interactive. It allows you to create a single web page that can have multiple interactions with the web server. This allows for the creation of online applications such as Google Documents, for example, or the Zoho suite of applications, or things like Gliffy, GLIFFY.com, which is a web page that allows you to draw diagrams, flowcharts, and things like that. And that's three of hundreds and hundreds of these applications in a web page. But one of the things that we're seeing is more and more people are using online applications like this instead of applications that would be loaded on their computer, like Microsoft Office, Word document, or PowerPoint slides. One of the reasons for this is that it doesn't matter what computer you're on, you can always access your application, and therefore you can always access your data. So if you're at a cyber cafe in Kuala Lumpur, and you just log on, you can go to Google Docs and work on your document, just as though you're on your own home computer. The other thing that's important is, if the document is online on a website like that, you can work on that document at the same time that other people are working on that document. The classic example, of course, is the wiki. But right now, I'm writing a paper with a friend of mine. We're working on Google Docs. It was just last night, in fact, I'm sitting there typing on the paper, and he's typing on the paper at the same time. We're both working on the same document at the same time. And it's live. Brilliant. I love it. Half the paper written like that. Unfortunately, that was the easy half. Another major aspect of Web 2.0 technologies is representational state transfer. probably best described in contrast to something that you've probably seen a lot of buzz about, web services. Web services, which are supported by the Simple Object Access Protocol, or SOAP, as diagrammed at the bottom, are very structured, very, I consider them very top-heavy. There's a lot of infrastructure. I think that they're slow. REST does the same sort of thing as web services, but it does it in a very lightweight sort of way. Data on the web and services on the web are accessed simply by sending a call to a web address, a URI. And the importance of this is that it gives online websites, online services, a very simple, low overhead way of rapidly sending data back and forth. And this allows us to merge and combine data from multiple websites. That leads us to the concept of the mashup. And the idea of the mashup is you're working with data from one application, data from another application, mashing it together to create a new application. One of my current favorites is working with Flickr, which is a place where I store my photographs because I have nowhere nearly enough disk space on my computer to store my photographs, especially now that I've got an 8 megapixel camera, which I'm so pleased about. So I upload my photos to Flickr, and then I access, I just click on organize my photos, and then map, and that opens up a Google map, which Flickr has accessed from the Google site, and then I drag and drop my photo onto the Google map, and it creates location data for my photo. So this mashup here is allowing me to use two separate applications on separate websites, Google Maps and Flickr, in order to create data that I couldn't have created otherwise. Very precise latitude and longitude locations for my photographs. Now, just as an aside, imagine, as is currently happening, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people geotagging all of their Flickr photos. There are billions of Flickr photos. For any location on the planet, you'll have photographs that have been taken by dozens and dozens and dozens of people. Another major aspect is JSON. The only thing I'll say about JSON right now, for those of you who work on Storm and shareable objects and face the cross-domain scripting problem, JSON solves the cross-domain scripting problem. JSON allows what is known as the tag pack. Basically, what it is a way of importing into the head or the body of an HTML document structured data in the form of JavaScript arrays that can be used by JavaScripts on the current page. So basically, I create the data on one place on my own web server, import it as JSON, and use it on another web server, thus solving the cross-domain scripting problem. Brilliant. I love it. It's so simple. Just as an aside again, JSON eventually is going to be a serious, serious challenger to XML. Finally, OpenID, which I mentioned earlier. OpenID is a technology, a very simple technology, that allows people to have a single identity across all of these different websites. And you can see how having the same identity across all of these different websites is going to leverage a lot of the interactivity, a lot of the mashups that the connections between these websites enable. This is a bit of an aside, but it treats your identity as personal rather than institutional. I have no idea how that's going to play out in your context. I think your context is a bit special. But for learning institutions like universities and colleges, this is going to have a big impact because historically, the person, the individual, the student, has always been defined by the institution. You have your university login, your university number, your university ID. That's who you are. But as learning happens more and more as a consequence of an interaction between multiple websites, your identity has to persist across those websites, which means that it cannot be defined by any one of those websites. And in practice, what that means is it takes the definition of an identity out of the hands of the institution and puts it into the hands of the individual. You define your own identity, which you then project into these different web services. So it means, basically, again, your context might be different, but for the rest of the world, an end to walled gardens, a way of sharing social networks and content networks across institutions, across websites. Now, I just want to, and I have like what, 1 minute? I just want to talk very briefly about networks, and I'm going to zip through a few slides here, and not deliberately, but what this has to do with is how to design these structures, these networks, so that they're effective. Because one of the things about networks is just because it's a network doesn't mean it's good. Just because it's a network phenomenon doesn't mean it's good. Networks can have bad results as well. Sometimes known as cascade phenomena. If a disease spreads through a network of people, for example, that's a bad thing. Well, unless you're the disease, in which case it's a good thing. But I mean, but for the people, it's a bad thing. So you need to set up your networks so that they're resistant to this. You need to set up your networks so that connectivity is possible, so that you can create this web of interactivity, but also in such a way that you minimize the risk of cascade phenomena and other things that will inhibit the function of the network. So I'm just going to skip through why networks, and skip through the distinction between groups and networks, which is a way of approaching this, and talk about networks as ecosystems and think about what makes a successful ecosystem. And out of this, and again, this is just my activeness, right? I've come up with what I call the semantic principle. The semantic principle is the set of conditions that allow us to create reliable networks. And there are 4 major principles to the semantic principle: diversity, autonomy, openness, and interaction. Diversity is the idea that the elements or the members of the network represent the widest possible spectrum of points of view. And so you think about your brain, right? You don't want all of your neurons doing the same thing all the time in your brain. That would be really silly, right? Your brain would cease to function. Your brain would be inert, like a lump of iron. What you want are different neurons doing different things at different times. You want each neuron to have its own individual, unique set of connections, its own different perspective, point of view on the world. The idea of a network is you're collecting these many different perspectives and combining them to create a new overall view of reality. Autonomy, and this is tied very closely to diversity. In order to get this diversity, each of these individuals in the network needs to work autonomously. And by autonomously, I don't mean simply making their own decisions, but also making these decisions against their own background, against their own perspective, their own culture, their own worldview. So we get a very genuine set of, distinct points of view or perspectives on any given state of affairs or entity. Openness. You need openness in order to ensure that all of these different perspectives are heard and that no perspective is omitted from this overall collection. Openness allows all perspectives from all points of view to contribute to the network, to create what Rudolf Carnap used to call the total possible evidence. Carnap's requirement was the requirement for evidence. And then finally, connectivity. And this is kind of a tricky principle, but the idea here is that the knowledge in a network is not the propagation of some knowledge from one individual to another, but rather the knowledge that is creating the network is created by the interaction of the network as a whole and is not simply a reflection of the knowledge contained in any individual. And that's a bit of a tricky concept, especially to explain in less than 5 seconds. But if you think about it, if you're looking at a television set, you see a picture of Richard Nixon, What makes the picture a picture of Richard Nixon has nothing to do with any individual pixel. There's no pixel of a little tiny representation of Richard Nixon that is bull nut big. Each pixel is just a little black and white dot. Richard Nixon exists in that set of pixels only as a result of all of those pixels working together. Similarly, another example, flying an airplane from London to Canada. No single individual can do this. No single individual can build the airplane, make the tires, pump the gas, navigate the airplane, take off the airplane, transport the airplane across the ocean, land the airplane without crashing. It's just too much work for any given individual to do. That knowledge is distributed across a set of individuals. Those four principles, those four semantic principles, are intended to provide, if you will, a framework or a metric for the evaluation, design, and selection of Web 2.0 and e-learning 2.0 technologies. And with that, more or less on time, I conclude my talk, and I thank you for your patience and your attention.
Stephen will stay and take questions. If you have any questions, if you want to go off the lunch now, you can do that as well. So it's up to you. Any questions?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Put me in
here. Everybody's on lunch.